nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the second session of the course on nanoscience and nanotechnology. And today it's my great pleasure to introduce my colleague, Chad Jabbert, who is a professor of civil engineering, particularly in the area of aquatic chemistry in the environmental engineering division. He obtained his bachelor's degree in biochemistry at Iowa State University, then went to the University of Iowa, where he obtained both his master's degree and his PhD degree. And before coming to Purdue, he was a postdoctoral fellow of the National Research Council, and he was assigned to the United States Environmental Protection Agency in Athens, Georgia. And over the years, I have had the pleasure of working with Chad and admiring some of the good things they do over there concerning the environment. But this time, he's going to specialize and talk to us on the ecological implication of nanotechnology.
Thank you. I want to thank Jack for inviting me to talk today. The title in the handout, the wall handout for me, was Nanomaterials in the Aquatic Environment. And so, as you can see, I sort of changed the title a little bit, Ecological Implications of Nanotechnology, just because when you're talking about nanomaterials in the environment, the question is, well, are they good or are they bad? And the answer is, we don't know yet. So, and you'll see that. So, rather than give you a handout on my overheads, what I've done is, and I'll show you some of these questions at the end. I've prepared a list of questions for you to think about. And some of these you could even ask the other speakers that are coming that are talking about the nanomaterials they make to say, do you know anything about the implications of these? Do you know about the toxicity of the materials you're working with? Do you know the environmental fate of the materials you're working with? Because that's actually one of the big questions about nanotechnologies. How safe are these materials, not just for humans, but for our environment? So the topics that I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to, in order to address, well, are these materials good or are they bad? First, you have to talk about how you do standard risk assessment. So I'm going to go through the basic way the EPA does risk assessment of typical chemicals like pesticides and other compounds that we use in everyday use. And then I'll give you examples of nanomaterials, and then we'll talk about issues concerning nanomaterials in the environment. These issues include toxicity, detection, because these are new, novel compounds. They're not really compounds. They're larger than compounds. Are there even ways that we can use to detect whether they're in our foodstuff or in things that we don't want them in? And how do you predict risk for these materials? I'll give you a little bit of background about the research that I do at Purdue, and then answer your questions, hopefully. So risk assessment of chemicals is possible because chemicals, I'll give you a list of reasons why risk assessment of chemicals is possible. If you look at the history of the EPA, they've had 40 years now to get good at this. They can monitor chemicals. They can predict toxicity of chemicals. They can predict environmental fate of chemicals, and they have models to do so. And then all of a sudden, here comes nanotechnology. And it's like, okay, well, what do we do now? Because we can't use the standard methods that we've used for typical chemicals like these three. Estradiol. Does anybody know what the problems of estradiol are these days?
What is it?
Estradiol is a hormone. And it's a hormone that basically is given to cattle, to hogs, to other things. and there's a whole bunch of these hormones. So steroids are given to cattle for growth. And then the steroids get in the manure, and the manure runs off the fields, and all of a sudden you have fish that are exposed to basically endocrine disruptors or hormones that affect the, you know, whether during the mating, you get all the frogs coming out, males or females, because they have been exposed to these types of compounds. So it becomes an issue. Nonylphenol is a problem because it's basically a compound that may result from the breakdown of certain surfactant agents. So some surfactants have been banned because they may produce nonylphenol in the environment. And decabromodiphenyl ether is a compound that recently the industry that produces it just decided to phase out because they could see the regulations coming down that says that the EPA would probably ban that chemical. It's been banned in Europe for use as a flame retardant, but it breaks down into other compounds that are bioaccumulative. So there's evidence that its concentrations are increasing in the environment, and it may also have some estrogenic activity, whereas other compounds that we've banned in the past, like DDT and PCBs, their concentration in the environment is going down. Chemicals have known structure and molecular weights, usually less than 1,000. So if you take carbon on any one of these molecules, it's got a molecular weight of 12. So you can see that for this compound, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, well, nonyl, 9 here, plus 6 here. You've got that many carbons on it times 12 gives you a molecular weight that's, you know, a couple hundred or something like that. So most chemicals have molecular weights less than 1,000. And so because of that, if you take off one of these bromines, it becomes a different compound, but you can detect it because we have ways of separating those compounds. So chemicals can be separated, detected, and quantified instrumentally. One of my favorite shows is NCIS. How many of you watch NCIS? One of my favorite people in that show is Abby, because Abby's in a lab with her GC-MS detecting compounds, right? She detects compounds the same way, at least the person on the show detects compounds the same way, as environmental scientists detect compounds in the environment, because we use the same tools. We use GCs, gas chromatographs, and liquid chromatographs, and other tools to basically separate compounds out and then measure their and quantify them in the environment. So a GC is a very simple thing. It has an oven right here, and it has a gas that flows through it, and you inject the sample here, and basically you have maybe a 50-meter column. So this is wrapped around here many, many times, and as the compounds are eluted onto this column, they separate because of their vapor pressure. So some of the times they're adsorbed onto the column, sometimes they come off, they adsorb, so they're partially in the mobile phase in the gas stream, partially on the solid phase. And as a result, those compounds that are more volatile, those that are in the gas phase more, they come out faster and you see peaks earlier. And the compounds that are more on the solid phase, they have a higher affinity for the solid phase, they come out later. So you can take 200 compounds and separate them all on one chromatograph in a GC. These are chemicals, right? Not nanoparticles yet. They're chemicals. So we can separate chemicals. We can detect them in the environment. So this is a trace of a bunch of PAH compounds. These are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that you can separate on a GC column. And you can see at this end is ethyl benzene and at the other end is chrysine. So chrysine is this large molecule that's got 6 aromatic rings to it. And it's, some of these compounds at this end are carcinogens or suspected carcinogens. But this is basically material from a coal tar sample. And you can see that even besides these 16 compounds, which we can identify by their retention time, there's all of these other compounds that are out there that you can quantify too. And you can tell what compound they are because of nice analytical ways of detecting these compounds. So chemicals, they have known molecular weights, They can be separated and detected and quantified. And like I said, we've spent decades perfecting these tools so that we can quantify chemicals in the environment. Chemicals have unique physical chemical properties that allow their degradation pathways, transport, and fate in the environment to be predictable. These are some of those. Let me just talk a little bit about octanol water partition coefficients. Octanol is an oil. It's kind of like vegetable oil in a way, right? So if you put vegetable oil and water together, you get the water down here, you get vegetable oil at the top, or it could be octanol. Well, if you put an organic compound in that mixture, typically the organic compound would reside primarily in the octanol phase and not in the water phase. If you put a water-soluble compound in, like a salt, sodium chloride, it'll predominantly exist in the water phase. So chemicals have properties that allow them to be, like an octanol water partition coefficient, that allow you to determine, will that compound primarily want to go to your fatty tissues, or will it basically be very water soluble and excreted out of your blood, you know, in urine and other things? In other words, will it stay in your body or will it not stay in your body? Why are certain compounds found in polar bears in the Arctic? Because they like to go to the lipid of the organism. Pharmacologists use those types of partition coefficients all at the time to detect or to determine how bioaccumulative will a compound be in an organism, whether it's you or whether it's a fish in a stream or in a lake. We use these parameters, these measurable parameters and other parameters to basically calculate the transport of these compounds. If a compound has a high octanol water partition coefficient, that means it predominantly goes to the octanol phase as opposed to the water phase. It's like going to vegetable oil, right? We call it lipophilic. Lipid is oil, philic it loving. It likes to be in the oil phase. If it likes to be in an oil phase, then it also likes to be in organic carbon in soil. If it likes to be in organic carbon in soil, then if you put it on a farm field, it'll stay in the farm field because it sticks to the organic carbon in that soil. If it's very water soluble, it'll run off of the soil very readily. So you can actually predict the fate and transport of these compounds in the environment by some of these physical chemical properties of the compounds that you can measure. Okay? So, and you need to know the hydrology cycle. This is a pretty, not very good picture, but it was one of the only ones I could find on the web that basically showed, you know, precipitation. We can basically estimate from the chemical properties and from ecological modeling, we can estimate exposure concentrations of chemicals to fish. If you apply a pesticide to a farm field, how much should end up in the water? How much of that chemical will biodegrade before it gets to the water phase? So it's not just where is the chemical, but how fast does it biodegrade in the system? This is when they talk about, commercials during Purdue basketball games. No carryover on this herbicide. What does that mean? It means from 1 year to the next year, it biodegrades. If it's not taken up by the plant or something like that, the pesticide will degrade on the farm field so that you don't have it in the farm field the next year, which is a good thing because then you don't have it accumulating in the soil. Okay, so no carryover. That's a biodegradation or physical loss process out of the system. So knowledge of the hydrological cycle is critical for understanding fate of chemicals in the environment, as water is one of the primary media through which humans and ecosystems are exposed. So chemical exposure modeling is very important in predicting risk of chemicals in the environment. So as a result, EPA and academic researchers have spent many decades building these models to basically predict exposure to humans and exposure of chemicals in the environment. This is just one. I love this. Kabam. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it, but I'll pronounce it that way. Kabam. It uses KOW. Again, the KOW is the octanol water partition coefficient. Because if we know the octanol water partition coefficient, we can predict the concentration in marsh rice rats and the snar-nosed mole and the American mink and the northern river otter, right? We can predict concentrations of different pesticides in these different organisms just simply by using physical chemical properties of these compounds that help us predict what their concentration is going to be in these different organisms in the environment. And so you build models. Medium fish, large fish, zooplankton. Zooplankton are the small critters that the fish eat. You have filter feeders and you have benthic invertebrates like crawfish and mayfly larvae. And all of these organisms that live at the benthic zone is the sediment water interface. So you have all these organisms that live at the sediment water interface. And you have, you know, higher trophic level, the fish species living in the water column and everything else. And then you have the mammals up here at the higher trophic levels. So if you have a chemical in the system, you can predict trophic transfer between one level of organism and the higher levels of organism because of food chains and everything else. So you can model these systems. This is another one, Ecological Committee on Risk Assessment Methods, Aquatic Exposure Assessment. FIFRA is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Roticide Act. So they're the ones that regulate all of these pesticides, all of these fungicides and everything else to make sure that these compounds don't bioaccumulate in the environment and they don't persist in the environment from year to year and that they're breaking down and that they're not going to pose a toxic threat to humans and other organisms. So what parameters do you need? KOC. KOC you get from a KOW because that KOC is the organic carbon water partition coefficient as opposed to so it would be like a soil organic carbon to water partition coefficient. You need transformation rates, photolysis rates. Does the compound break down by photochemistry? Okay. Does it hydrolyze? Does it break down in aerobic soils, meaning in the presence of oxygen? Does it break down in anaerobic soils, which is in the absence of oxygen? So you have all these rate constants for all of these compounds that EPA and other people have been collecting for years and years and years to basically keep people in ecosystems safe, to make sure that we're not using chemicals that are going to accumulate and cause all sorts of problems. So here's another thing. This is for pesticide exposure. So we have all these nice models, and it's a good thing because we know about chemicals. And then comes nanotechnology, right? Okay, now we don't have chemicals anymore. Now we have particles. And so how do you do that? We'll get to that in a minute. This is now an applied example, mercury cycling. So if you have that previous one, which is sort of a generic one for pesticides, well, you can say, well, how does mercury behave in the environment? How, you know, does it bioaccumulate in different organisms? What does it cycle through? You have mercury at +2 and it forms methylmercury and it gets into organisms, accumulates mercury, zero valent mercury itself, which is the liquid mercury is actually somewhat volatile. So some of it volatilizes into the air. So you have all of these models for all of these different compounds. So the summary, chemicals have known structures. They can be separated, detected, quantified instrumentally. Chemicals have unique physical chemical properties that allow their degradation pathways, their environmental transport. This is from, you know, ground to river to sediment and fate in the environment to be predictable. So we can predict things, so we have a good idea of what's going on. Also, additionally, their ecological toxicity can be assessed. So on the other side of campus, you have toxicologists who are taking these chemicals and dosing them and seeing how toxic are they to various organisms. So this is a case of atrazine, yes, right here, atrazine concentration versus percent reproduction failure. So with the control, you get a little bit because, you know, not everything always works, But then once you get up to 250 micrograms per liter concentration, you have about 35% reproductive failure with atrazine with this particular organism. So you do dose response curves. And besides dose response curves, the other tool that toxicologists have are epidemiology studies. We can't do toxicity assays on humans. You know, it's impossible. We don't do that. So to do human exposure, you need epidemiology studies. How do they know that asbestos causes cancer in humans? Because they have a control group of people that were highly exposed to asbestos in the workplace versus a control group of people that weren't exposed to asbestos in the workplace. And they do the statistics to say, yes, the difference between this is these people were exposed and these people, and a certain percentage of these got cancer. And so therefore the epidemiology points to the fact that asbestos fibers in your lungs cause cancer. Okay? One of the compounds that is under a lot of scrutiny recently is atrazine, which is one of the herbicides we use. This is a map showing the use of atrazine, and it's basically used in the Corn Belt. And this is high lymphoma areas, and you can see the Midwest is a high lymphoma area compared to the rest of the country. So a lot of people claim that, well, from sort of an, it's not exactly an epidemiology study, that atrazine may cause all sorts of problems. We use 67 million pounds of atrazine a year. So when you think of chemicals in the environment, sometimes these are huge quantities of chemicals. 67 million pounds of atrazine is applied all over the Midwest every year. Okay? So if you look at nanotechnology, it's in infancy now. So what products are going to be made that are nanomaterials that are going to be used in these quantities in the next couple of decades? We don't even know what they will be at this point in time. But there could be some that are used in, huge major quantities. Also one comment. Atrazine was banned by the European Union in 2004, and there's pressure. It's used in 80 countries right now, but there's pressure in the U.S. also to at least maybe restrict its use or ban it, but I don't know if that will happen. So again, summary, what have I been talking about? What I've been talking about is the fact that four elements of risk assessment, exposure assessment. We know chemical properties. We know how to model ecology. And so we can predict exposure concentrations of chemicals in the environment to specific organisms. On the other side, the toxicologists do dose response assessment. So the hazard identification is like, pick your chemical. Which one do you think is causing a problem? Let's do the exposure modeling. Let's do the toxicity assays. Let's combine it in an overall risk assessment. And that's where the scientists leave it off, because this is up to the policymakers then. This is up to the government to decide, are we going to ban the use of this chemical, or are we not going to ban the use of this chemical? So these top four are the four elements of a typical risk assessment that you do on a chemical, okay, in the environment. I threw this in at this point make a point that we're over 6 billion people on Earth right now. That's part of the reason why you were using, 78 million pounds of atrazine. Humans, we use billions of pounds of anthropogenic. Anthropogenic is a fancy word for man-made chemicals, okay? We use man-made chemicals produced each year. We are affecting the health of ecosystems. That's clear. Even just by, urban sprawl and everything else, we affect ecosystems in major ways. We affect ecosystems by how we use the land, but we also affect ecosystems by all of the chemicals that we spread on the land and other ways too. So we are affecting ecosystems. The population of the world is here, and in 50 years, it's predicted to be 9 billion people. So we have major issues, right, on sustainability, because we have to get that population curve to bend over so that the population of the earth becomes stable. But that means also that we use a lot of chemicals now. We're going to use a lot of chemicals in the future. And nanotechnology is ramping up, and we're going to probably be using a lot of nanomaterials in the future too. Okay? We just don't know which ones at this point in time. So now we're done with sort of classic risk assessment of chemicals. We're going to put that aside, and we're going to talk about nanomaterials. And unfortunately, I wasn't here for Jack's talk last time, but I'll just briefly discuss some of the materials. I don't know a whole lot about all of these materials. I've worked a lot with fullerenes, and I've started some work with nanotubes. There's a lot of people at Purdue who are interested in graphene. These are carbon-based materials. So graphene, for example, are sheets like this of basically six-membered carbon rings. These are like benzene rings, all in one sheet. So that's one sheet off out of basically coal, but since it's a separate sheet, it has properties that make it different than coal. This is C60, which is Buckminster fullerene, one of the fullerenes. Nanotubes are these types of structures. And then you have a picture here of what looks like a whole bunch of hairs, because nanotubes, basically, they can be molecular dimensions in two dimensions, but then they can be very, very long. So they're basically nanomaterials in the length dimension, but then in the radius dimension, they can be on sort of the molecular scale. So they also have unique properties. The metallic materials are gaining a lot of interest. Zero valent metals such as iron, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but then we also have semiconductor materials. They can be silicas, oxides. Some of these materials may be very, very benign. They may pose no risk when we use them. We use silica all of the time anyway. It's sand. So some nanomaterials will have no environmental implications in the future. Other nanomaterials may have major environmental implications in the future, and they may be banned before they get widely used. So I'm not here just to tell you that all these materials are bad. They're not. Some of them we will use very, very effectively, and they'll save energy. They'll save, consumption of other materials. So there's lots of excellent good uses for nanomaterials. The question is which ones are the ones that we should be concerned about? Okay. Quantum dots over here are unique because, these colloidal quantum dots irradiated with UV light, they fluoresce. Different size quantum dots emit different colors. Colored light due to a quantum confinement. These quantum dots are made out of cadmium and selenium. Both of those are fairly hazardous materials. So if we use lots of quantum dots, well, it may not be bad. If we use quantum dots for certain applications where we can recover the heavy metals from it, it may be fine. Okay? Carbon nanotubes. Here's C60. C60 is a truncated isohedron symmetry, 20 hexagons, 20 pentagons. So every carbon in this is at the junction of two hexagons and one pentagon. And if you kind of stretch it out a little bit, you get nanotubes. The nanotubes can have this armchair configuration, or they can be zigzag. So the difference is, if you look, rather than looking at the tube this way, if you stand it on end, the carbon-carbon bonds for a chair structure go like this, down, and then like this. So they basically have a seat, sides, and then up. Whereas the zigzag basically goes like this. And the difference between these configurations are the roll-up angles. You can take a graphene sheet and you can roll it like this, or I can roll it like that. So I can, roll it and twist it a little bit, or I can roll it and basically not twist it a little bit. So you have twisted configure zigzag nanotubes also, or you have chiral nanotubes where it's in between the armchair and the zigzag structure. Part of the reason people are so interested in these nanotubes are because of the roll-up angle, because of what is known as their chirality, The nanotubes either conduct electricity really, really well, so you have ones that behave like metals, they're metallic, or they don't conduct electrons real effectively, and that means that they're semiconducting nanotubes. So you have metallic and you have semiconducting nanotubes. So something made out of exactly the same material, carbon, just because it's in a different, slightly different configuration, makes a difference on whether these tubes behave one way or they behave another way, which is very fascinating. Here's quantum dots. So again, quantum dots, the size, color is due to the different particle size. These are for the same material, but just with different size dots in solution, or in suspension, I guess. But you can also have different colors as a result of different formulations. So you can put different metals in. Zinc, cadmium, and sulfur, or cadmium, selenium, all sorts of different mixtures of different heavy metals to give you these different colors, okay? And a lot of people want to use these basically for imaging because they are colors. Well, we can put them under microscopes, we can see them. So they have, if they have affinities for different cell materials, well, then we can see where they're going in the cells. And so that's, you know, for biological activity and things like that. Zero valent metals. Iron in the environmental engineering area has got a lot of interest lately because a lot of chlorinated solvents break down under very reduced environmental conditions. So if you have a dry cleaner site that has chlorinated solvents spilled there, you want to break down those chlorinated solvents. Well, how do you do it? Zero valent iron works effectively because you have to, the iron gets oxidized and the chlorinated solvent gets reduced. So you basically take the chlorine off and put a hydrogen on the solvent and now it becomes a hydrocarbon rather than a chlorocarbon molecule. So iron, zero valent iron is a very effective reactant in the environment. So if you look at a zero valent iron, that is basically metallic iron particle in the environment. If it's a large particle, you only have a certain surface area. So how do we increase the rate of reaction? We make the surface area really, really small. So that now you got more particles for the same mass of particles, but very, very high surface area. So make the particles extremely small. So if you make nano iron, you have a very, very high surface area, high reactivity on these materials, and so you get a lot more basic pollutant degradation because you're using nano iron rather than larger particles of iron. So this, even for environmental restoration, may be a good thing. Iron's a natural material. It's non-toxic. It's non-toxic, at least in most environmental applications. So it may be a good thing. Silver has antimicrobial activities, and I'll show you that in a couple of slides. And gold also, gold nanoparticles, these are all zero valent metals. So this is like silver that you use for flatware. And this is like gold in wedding rings and things like that. It's just that now the particles are nano-sized particles. And because they're nano-sized particles, you can do many, many different things with them, including tag them with other chemicals. Or silver itself, like I said, antimicrobial. Where are these? These are gold. These are gold nanoparticles. But depending upon how you make these in solution, you can make gold nanorods. And if you're clever in the lab, you can actually functionalize them with other groups. Okay? And here's a nanorod that is functionalized, just a cartoon of a nanorod that is functionalized with other groups. Okay? And down here, nano gold toothpaste in South Korea. You can buy toothpaste now in South Korea that has gold in it. I don't know why you would want to, but you can. Here's lotions too, skin creams with gold in them. So what's the toxicity of nano gold? I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily want to use this until I had some approval of some agency that said this stuff was okay to use. It may be fine, but it may be not fine. Diameter of gold nanoparticles determines the wavelength of light absorbed. So these are nanoparticles of gold that basically are different sizes. I'm not sure what the scale is here, but it's not that important. It's just that, you know, nanoparticles have all sorts of unique properties just because of the sizes, including even the colors. And gold, for example, silver, this is the spectrum of light, and silver basically reflects all of the light. That's why it appears silver, whereas gold only reflects the light that's between about 800 and 600 nanometers, the light up at the high nanometer range. So gold has a gold appearance. So the particles, there's a couple reasons why they the particles themselves have different properties than the bulk material. No more stinky socks. This one works. Nano antimicrobial smart thread bacteria and odor. What are these? These are 100%, they claim 100% biodegradable, recyclable, and sustainable. Fibers of natural wood-based yarn and silver ions. It's not silver ions that's in the sock. They take the silver ions and then they reduce it to zero valent silver, which is like the silver that is in jewelry and things like that. It's metallic silver, basically. And so you have these nano silver particles that you put in socks, and nano silver is very antimicrobial. If it's antimicrobial, that means it kills the bacteria that are in your feet that give you the odor. It's not your feet that stinks, it's the bacteria on your feet that basically stink, right? So if you put these socks on, you supposedly have less odorous smell. The point is, though, is do we want to use our silver that way? Silver is a resource. Do we really need to put silver in our socks to kill bacteria, or should you just wash your feet better, right? Or wash your socks more. Exactly. And so the question is, silver ions, is it completely 100% biodegradable? You can't degrade silver. Silver is either of one redox state or another. It's either zero valent, like silver jewelry, or it's usually the plus one form in water. So Ag plus one is a species that's basically dissolvable in water. So it exists in different species, but it doesn't ever biodegrade. So the wood fiber in the sock may be biodegradable, but the silver's got to go someplace. So where's the silver going? When you wash the socks, some of it leaches out and goes to the wastewater treatment plant. When you dispose of the socks, it goes to the landfill. So you're basically, when you buy these socks, you're throwing silver away, right? You're not disposing of much silver, but you're disposing of some silver. So if there's 300 million people in the U.S., if 300 million people buy socks that have silver in it, how much silver are we disposing of that we don't need to be disposing of? Is it a very sustainable? Yes. So they say it is sustainable. How sustainable is this? After 200 years, all our silver would be in socks? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me, right? Okay. Nano silver hand creams. You can buy hand creams now. I don't know if you can buy these in this country. I don't think so. But in other countries, you can buy hand creams with silver in it. Because the same thing. It kills bacteria, and so as a result, you know, it helps you with the skin. Widely used iron nanoparticles exhibit toxic effects on neuronal cells. Unexpected effects on cells noted while investigating a possible way of manipulating them remotely with magnetic forces. Iron is an essential nutrient for mammals. In other words, you know, iron is usually not toxic, but when you have nano iron and you're putting it in mammalian cells, you don't know what's going to happen. So basically, you know, we need to study more about these things. They were trying to use it for a good purpose, but it ended up being toxic to some cells. popular nanoparticles cause toxicity in fish, study says. This is, hey, West Lafayette, Indiana. This is our colleagues over in the forestry department who use nanosilver, and here's nanosilver, and expose them to certain fish, and the fish didn't like it very well. So if the silver is in your socks and your silver gets in the waterways, and if everybody's buying nano silver socks, you know, we're going to get nano silver in the environment. It may not be that great a thing. Again, it's a risk assessment thing. You go back to my first slides about risk assessment. It's how much chemical or how much material is in the environment, what are the exposure concentrations, is it going to have an effect, okay? And for nanomaterials, it's hard to do because we don't have the same properties that we can measure of these particles that we have built up databases for over the last few decades on for normal chemicals that are very, very small type chemicals. Safety fears over nanocosmetics containing tiny nanoparticles are being used widely despite unresolved issues surrounding their safety, a consumer watchdog warns. This is in 2008, so it's not that long ago. I mean, it took us 30 years to basically figure out chemicals. Now throw us a whole new type of material, and it's like, it's going to take people a while to figure out, you know, what's going on with these materials. Toxic warnings for nano industry. This is BBC News. Industry should disclose how it tests products containing nanoparticles, the Royal Society of UK has said. So there's a lot of concern in Europe, there's a lot of concern in this country, because the idea is do we use these materials before we really test their safety to see how safe they really are? And what I'm kind of suggesting is we don't even know how to test these materials yet, because they're not the classic chemicals that people have tested in the past. In vitro toxicity of gold nanoparticles on human lung fiberglass cells. One nanomolar, that's a low concentration, by the way. Nanogold may have a damaging effect on cells and destroy DNA. Nanoparticle toxicity and oxidative stress assessed through pulmonary cell models. An increase in ROS and subsequent alteration of antioxidant systems as well as cell death. ROS is reactive oxygen species. So why do they say you should drink red wine? Because of its antioxidant properties, right? You may lower your risk of cancer because cancer is caused by, you know, free radicals in your system, and free radicals can attack DNA. So if you've got a natural system that scavenges those free radicals, then you have a lower probability of getting cancer. So if nanomaterials are causing free radicals to form in your body, well, does that mean that you have an increased incidence of potential cancer? That's one of the questions on the table, right? So this study tends to state that, yes, you have reactive oxygen species that are formed, and therefore, you know, it could cause alteration of your antioxidant system as well as cell death. The chemical composition of the particles is the dominant factor in determining the impact of the nanoparticle would have on the cell. So there's lots of studies ongoing on toxicity issues with nanomaterials. Okay. Shellfish absorb waste nanoparticles, scientists alarmed by potential environmental threat. So if they're toxic and if they get in the environment and shellfish are accumulating them because they're filter feeders and they're particles, so they accumulate in their body, you know, that's not a good thing too. So this comes back to the exposure concentration, how much of these particles potentially could be getting into organisms. Again, I want to stress, not all nanomaterials may show toxicity or other factors like this. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just sort of the, you know, one in the back of the crown saying, well, you know, we've got to know more about these things before we know that that we should be using them. Ask the right questions. So here's some of my questions. So I'll pass some of these around. I at the end of my talk, I have these, but here you go. But these are just general questions about, you know, how do you know these things are safe? We'll get to some of those in a minute. Okay, now comes the tricky part. This compound is a PCB, polychlorinated biphenyl. It has, on each of these rings, it's got six carbons. Each of these points is a carbon atom. And so it can be chlorinated in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 places on each ring. Okay? This is a chemical. And so, since it's a chemical, you have 5 over here, and you can be chlorinated in 5 positions over here. So if you take chlorine and you put it on each of these positions, let's take off all of the chlorines to start with. I can put a chlorine here, and that's a unique molecule. I can put a chlorine here, that's a unique molecule. I can put a chlorine here, that's a unique molecule. If I put a chlorine here, it's the same as putting a chlorine here because I can turn the molecule around, it looks exactly the same. Okay? If I put 2 chlorines on, now I have a chlorine here, I got a chlorine here, well, I could put one here, I can put one here. So if I put 2 chlorines on, there's 12 different structures I could have that are unique structures for dichlorobiphenyl. By the time I'm up to 5, there's 46 different ways I can put those chlorines on that are unique. Okay? So when I get done putting either 1 chlorine all the way up to 10 chlorines on this molecule, I have 209 different compounds. I can actually go into my lab and I can detect almost all of those 209 compounds with the same GC that I showed you before. Because it's a chemical, because they have different vapor pressures, because they separate out on a GC nice, and I get all of these nice little peaks like I showed you before for PCBs. When you do a PCB analysis, and if you're a company that has PCB problems, you send it a sample off for analysis, they're going to charge you about $1,000 for a PCB analysis because it takes an hour to get one sample out of a gas chromatograph. It's very, very, very time consuming. So even measuring chemicals is difficult in the environment. This molecule has 10 places I can put chlorine on. Start putting chlorines on that molecule. And this is one of the problems, is if we functionalize these nanomaterials, we get all sorts of different things. How are we going to measure all those different compounds? Because they're not compounds anymore, they're nanomaterials, but they have functional groups all over the place. We can't even measure this in a way other than to look at it under a microscope with a transmission electron microscope. Or maybe measure its functional groups, but there's no way to, it becomes very, very difficult to characterize it, and it becomes very, very difficult to extract it from the environment and try and measure it. So now, you know, go back to what I said about the chemicals with nanomaterials. If they get into the environment, it's going to be very, very difficult to detect whether they're even there. Okay? And that's going to take people 50 more years to figure out how to do. Well, 5 years for initial things, but, you know, until we get good at it, it's going to take a while. My point is try to detect this in the environment, or to detect this, or to detect this. This is a electron micrograph of nanotubes. So, yeah, I can see them but I have to separate them out from an environmental matrix, out of soil or something else, to detect whether they're there. Try to detect this compound, whatever it is. I think this is like a gold nanoparticle that is functionalized with a whole bunch of organic molecules on top of it. So now you just opened up, you know, this is just, okay, take a nanotube, it's open at one end, closed at the other end, but start functionalizing it. So this is cellular uptake of functionalized nanotubes. This was in Nature Nanotechnology in 2007 where they looked at these. I mean, now you got, you know, all sorts of different compounds. It's not just a nanotube anymore. People are putting functional groups on these to try and make them water soluble, to try and change their properties, to do all sorts of things with them. So you got all sorts of chemicals to potentially worry about if they're made in high concentrations. So there are methods to analyze these. You can use dynamic light scattering to tell the particle size if they're in water. You can use X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy to look at functional groups. You can use some spectroscopy methods to look at chirality. You can, for gold and silver nanoparticles, you can look at single particle by ICP-MS, which is actually for the metal species. It's pretty easy because we can measure metals fairly easily in the lab as opposed to organics. And there are other spectroscopic methods. So I don't want to say there's no methods to measure these, but one of the biggest issues will be, can we actually recover them from soils or from water so that we actually can do good analysis on these materials? And just a few minutes, I don't have much time, right? Oh, good, okay. So I have some time to talk about what I do. So I'm in the environmental engineering area, and most of my research is on water chemistry. So I study the fate of chemicals in the environment. And one of the chemicals that I've looked at recently is C60. C60 is unique because when you put it in water, it starts forming these aggregates and starts forming these nanoparticles. So C60 itself is a molecule. It has a molecular weight of 720, which is smaller than some flame retardants. But if you put it in water, it forms these nice nano particles that basically will, you know, stay suspended. So you have a colloidal suspension of particles that are composed of C60. And a lot of people are interested in what these particles do because the particle itself now is a nanomaterial, not necessarily the molecule. The nice thing about C60, though, is I can take those clusters of C60 and I can break them apart in an organic solvent so that they're molecules now, and I can detect C60. So for me, it was a great chemical to start working on because I can treat it like a molecule when I want to, and I can treat it like a particle when I want to. So we did some studies on just octanol water partitioning of the molecule. We've done photochemistry of the molecule, and we've done some adsorption studies of the molecule. So how many of you have ever owned a black car? One person, two people, because you don't want to buy a black car because black cars are nice, shiny. My father always owned black cars. But in the middle of the summer, you put your hand on your car, and what happens? It's really, really hot. You can burn your hand because it's so hot. Why? Because the sunlight comes in, it hits the paint, and that paint is actually reacting. The color that you see is the molecules, the electrons will be excited in the upper orbitals because photons come in. Light energy can be quantified either as a wave or as a particle. And when it's a particle, we call it a photon. So a photon is basically amount of energy or a particle of light energy. So think of it as you can think of it like a particle. So a photon comes in, hits a molecule of paint, and basically that photon has energy, so that energy is transferred to the paint molecule. The paint molecule goes like this. And an electron gets excited into an upper orbital because the electrons are basically in their ground state. And so when that electron gets excited into the upper orbital, a couple things can happen. The paint in the car is made so that basically that electron decays back down to the ground state. And when it decays back down to the ground state, it emits that energy as heat. So you get a hot car. If you have a white car, the light is reflected, and so you don't see the color. With a black car, the light energy is absorbed, and the result of that is heat. But it's because of those, in the process of doing that, you get an electron transfer from the molecule. If you have blue jeans and you leave them out in the sun, what happens? What? It fades. Why does it fade? The same reaction happens as your black car. Only now some of the photons, the blue doesn't absorb all of the light, but it absorbs some of the light. Electron still gets promoted up into the outer orbital, and what happens? Now you get reaction, because the electron goes someplace else, it may be scavenged by water, something else, and basically that dye molecule that they put in your blue jean reacts photolytically, and it basically gets bleached. It's the same reaction as if you put your blue jeans in the wash with a lot of chlorine in it. You bleach them out. Why? Because the chlorine is a strong oxidant and it reacts with the dye in the blue jean to fade it to react. So it's chemical fate of blue jean dye. Okay? That's a reaction. Well, when you put C60 in light, it does the same thing kind of as a blue jean. Because the electron gets promoted and we call that the singlet state because electrons have two spins. And so when an electron gets promoted, one is a positive one half, one is a negative one half. And when an electron gets promoted, it goes up like this. And that's called the singlet. And this electron that's up here, it looks around and says, I can flip over. And now it's a triplet. So now it takes it a long time to come down back down to the ground state. So because it's up there longer, it can now react. And so that's what it does. C60 and C60. Why is the N here? Because those are the clusters. So you have C60 in a bunch of aqueous clusters. And they absorb sunlight. And they form, the electron gets promoted. Electron spins over. And electron reacts with oxygen. And this is molecular oxygen. It should be O2. And it goes back down to the ground state. This excited oxygen, so basically it's transferred the energy over to an oxygen molecule. So now the excited state of the oxygen is a singlet state, and the oxygen then can react with an excited C60 molecule to form an epoxide. So it basically oxidizes the C60. And in water, it probably hydrolyzes to give you this structure. So all of a sudden, you've just oxidized your C60 molecule. So now if you keep shining light on it, what's going to happen? You're going to have more and more of the C60 getting oxidized, and you're going to have more of this molecule getting oxidized. So if you look at putting C60 clusters in water, they look like this under the scanning electron microscope at day zero. They're 500 nanometer diameter, so very, very small particles, 500 nanometer diameter. After 65 days in the sunlight, they do exactly what blue jeans do. They fade, color fades. Why? Because they're reacting. They're reacting with the oxygen in the water, and now after 65 days, the average diameter of these particles is less than 100 nanometers. So if you're somebody who wants to use C60 in the environment, you may say, hey, this is a good thing. Why? Because they don't exist. They react in the environment. They go away. That's a real good thing. One of the problems is they go away and they also form reactive oxygen species. Because oxygen goes from the ground state to an excited state, and that singlet oxygen is a reactive oxygen species. One of those compounds that can react not just with C60, but it may be able to react with proteins. It could react with DNA. It potentially could react with other things. So it's like it's got the good and the bad, okay, going with it. So this compound breaks down in sunlight, color changes, size changes, average diameters change also. The amount of C60 here is 65 milligrams per liter. After 65 days, it's about half a milligram per liter. So the C60 is breaking down in the system. It's going away. I'm in environmental engineering. We're also interested in water treatment processes. So if you wanted to get rid of carbon nanomaterials, well, light may be an effective way of actually breaking compounds down too. Okay. Another possible reaction of this compound is polymerization. That when you excite it with light, it starts polymerizing, and now it becomes very, very difficult to detect this compound. So we haven't detected it yet, but there's a possibility that some of the C60 could actually polymerize. And in some organic solvents, in the absence of oxygen, it may do this. In the presence of oxygen, the compound oxidizes. And we've done some solubility studies too, where we calculate KOCs, we extrapolate, we do all sorts of things. So I won't go into this slide, but C60, since it behaves like a molecule, we can predict how much of it is going to absorb to soil from water. C60 is actually more hydrophobic than DDT. You know the DDT case? DDT, gets into the sediment. The worms eat the sediment. The fish eat the worms. The eagles eat the fish. And all of a sudden, the eggshells of the eagles softens until you don't have reproduction of eagles because all of the eggs are broken. So the lower 48 states, for a long time, the bald eagle population was decimated largely because of our use of DDT. The bald eagles are coming back now. Why? Because the environmental concentration of DDT is going way, 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 way down. So with this compound, one of its concerns is that its octanol water partition coefficient is about 10 million to 1. So it wants to be in the lipid phase almost exclusively over the water phase. It has a huge partition coefficient to oily substances. So that means that if, you know, you ingest it, probably it will be there for a long time. So safety issues. How do you handle this stuff? Okay, it becomes an issue. Even with other nanomaterials, it's hard to measure their physical chemical properties because usually we're measuring them on chemicals, but we can still measure the surface properties of these materials and sort of I get an idea of, well, will they be difficult to remove from biological materials or will they not be difficult to remove from biological materials? So it is photoreactive. Photodegradation results in water-soluble products also. These are a few of my graduate students standing out in their field. And these are our tubes of C60 nanoparticles being irradiated with sunlight out at Purdue's agronomy farms. So this slide I just kind of put in to bring you back, because this was a table out of a paper by some people in environmental science and technology recently, 2009. And it was because this year is the 40th anniversary of EPA. And so it was sort of a perspective of, well, has EPA been a good, you know, what have we learned and is, you know, where are we going from here? And they list centuries about where environmental regulations are going. Here's outcomes. In the 19th century, land preservation, you know, the Teddy Roosevelts, hey, we got to build national parks because this land, we got to save it before it's destroyed, right? The 20th century, pollution control. We built lots of wastewater treatment plants because we want to control pollution released to the environment, right? Management of anthropocentric ecological risk. Anthropocentric means man-made risk. The chemicals that we produce, let's minimize their release to the environment because that way we decrease the impact on humans to the environment. That's one way of lowering our ecological footprint, right? Is by basically not releasing lots of toxic pollutants to the environment. So that's what's gone on in the 20th century. 21st century, global sustainable development. Global sustainable development, I would say, includes these things. It's not stated here, but I think it is. Because we still have to reduce our risk. So when you're talking about global sustainable development, you're talking about doing things that are sustainable in the long term. And a lot of the practices we have right now are not sustainable, and we know it, right? We can't keep on doing them forever. We have to find other ways of doing things that are becoming, that are more sustainable in the future. It does not mean that we will not have pollution control in the future. We still have to do that. But it also means that, well, when you look at use of doing things this way or this way, it's like, no, we don't want to choose between these or these. We want to look over here and do things a whole new way, right? Be really, really clever about how we do things. Internationally, this is, I kind of like this slide because when you're protecting the environment, you have to say, we have to, What is the goal of protection? Do you want our streams, like in Europe, to actually be swimmable? I don't see many people doing this down on the Wabash River, right? But in Germany, unless you go up to the, what is it, the North Sea, where it's very, very cold, you don't want to go swim in the ocean. So we have Florida. They don't. Actually, a lot of Germans come to Florida, right? So where do they go to the beach? They go to the beach on their rivers. Okay. So that means that the water quality protection in Europe, they're a very, very stringent about it because they have a goal of making all of their rivers swimmable. And this is one case where attaining the goal of bathing water quality in this river in this, within the city of Munich.
Does that include swimming in the Rhine?
I don't think it includes the Rhine yet. And that's, but this is, this, so again, it may be a goal in the Rhine, but it may take them another 50 or 60 years to get there, right? Exactly. They have environmental problems just like we have environmental problems. Okay. So questions for other speakers. I'm at the end. So I don't know how I did on time, but I don't have all of the ones that I listed up here, but let's just go over a couple of these because you're going to hear other speakers. And like I said, some of these nanomaterials are completely, you know, safe. There's no problem with it. But the question is do we know which ones are safe? Do we know which ones are problematic? So the first one is, what precautions do you take in the lab so that you and your students are not directly exposed to nanomaterials? If you don't know if they're toxic or not, you know, are you making sure that your students are safe? What metals do they contain and are they toxic? When you make nanotubes, they're carbon. But to grow the nanotubes under extreme heat, you basically use metal catalysts. So the nanotubes themselves, when you buy them from the manufacturer, they contain yttrium, they contain sometimes I think cobalt, sometimes iron. They contain mixtures of metals. So the nanomaterial itself, the carbon nanotubes, may not be pure. They may be 5% metal content, and you don't even know what the metal content is. So the purity of these things is even an issue. And even with the cadmium, selenium, quantum dots, they obviously are made out of metal. So what metals are they, and are those metals toxic? Is it easy to separate the toxic metals from the nanomaterials you make? In other words, if you wanted to make this product and you wanted to recover the metals so that you could reuse them, could you do that? Or are these materials going to end up in a landfill someplace? Okay. Do you know anything about the toxicity of the materials you are making or the toxicity of their ingredients, such as the silver, the cadmium, and the titanium dioxide? What production rates do you expect these materials to eventually reach? This is I like this one because a lot of us in research, we don't have a clue about this, right? Well, we make something and then it hits and it's like, okay, everybody's using it. And it's like, there have been people that have done this, right? They've developed something and then they, oh, I wish I wouldn't have, because it's being used too much. How easy would it be to recycle products that contain some of the nanomaterials that you have discussed? So in the talks, you could ask them these are, I mean, I'm just giving you ideas of types of questions that you potentially could ask the other speakers about the ecological impacts of the materials that they're working with. And other ones. Are there any commercial products or uses that you think these materials should be excluded from? So are you targeting a specific industry like the medical profession on the nanomaterials that you use? Or do you know where they're going to be used? Or can you think of any instances where it's like, no, we shouldn't be using these materials, right? So that gives you sort of a list. You can read over the rest of them. And, I love this slide. Anybody know who this is? This is Buckminster Fuller. And what is this? This is it's a biosphere now. What was it originally? What? It's a geodesic dome, and basically Richard Smalley, who basically discovered buckyballs, he named buckyballs a C60 molecule after Buckminster Fuller because Buckminster Fuller was an architect who was in the 40s and 50s was designing all of these geodesic domes. And a geodesic dome basically looks like a buckyball, right? So he was like, I'll name it after the person who's been building these spherical shapes all of the time, and so he named it Buckminster Fuller. Is that, or it's actually Buckminster Fullerene, because it's a aromatic molecule. So the E-N-E ending is because of that aromaticity, just like benzene. So it's fullerene. What was this originally when it was built? Anybody know? I bet you some of you may have even gone there.
It was the U.S.
Pavilion at Expo 67. So do I have that? I think I have that. You got Buckminster Fuller, right? And this is the U.S. Pavilion at Expo 67. I remember I was a kid, like this tall, and my parents took me there through this pavilion. It's in Montreal. So right now it's the Montreal Biosphere, an Environmental Canada museum dedicated to water and the environment, which I think is amazing, because here I'm studying buckyballs in water, and this is a museum on water in a big buckyball. And does anybody know where he taught? He may have taught there, but his longest stint was at Southern Illinois University, in Carbondale, Illinois. What are buckyballs made out of? Carbon. They're fully carbon. And he taught at Carbondale. Okay, I'll leave it at that. Questions, yeah.
We have about 5 minutes for questions.
67, there weren't all those trees around there.
Yeah, it was the World's Fair. So, yeah.
So, do we have a question or two for Chad over here?
This may be covered in some of the other sessions, but if you're trying to form nanostructures of different kinds, certain kinds of tubes, or the balls or whatever, what in general are the approaches you take that should say, this would give me a tube like this, or this would give me a tube with different properties?
It's kind of like alchemy. I think of it that way, but the people who make them, I'm sure, wouldn't say that. But for example, the nanotubes, one of the ways to do it is to introduce, and I'm not sure if it's just carbon atoms or CO2, it's probably carbon atoms, nebulize them in a very, very high temperature, and basically the stuff starts growing, but it grows on a catalyst. So when it grows on the catalyst, it's a metal catalyst, and you have different, and so the ratio of the different metals that you put in determine the diameter and size and shape. So you have temperature that controls it, you have the metal ratios, because usually you're putting a bimetallic catalyst, two different metals at the same time. And so you get different growths and different lengths of the tubes too. You can grow them. There's lots of people who are doing lithography now, where they basically etch the metal catalyst in one location and not in others, so that the tubes will grow up from one location. And there's a great website that, if you search for Nanobama, there's a lithography of Obama basically made out of nanotubes, where they've grown up from a template. So I call it alchemy, because basically you're in the lab trying different things. You're trying different metallic ratios, and you're trying different temperatures. For nanotubes, there's basically four different ways to make them. And so if you buy the nanotubes made different ways, they'll have different properties. Once they make them, then they spend a lot of time actually separating them out. And there are ways by gravity separation to separate the metallic ones from the semiconducting ones. Actually, you have to spin them down at very, very high speed for a long period of time to separate them out, the same way they separate proteins in bands in biological studies. Yeah.
How much activity is there going on in other countries on this subject?
The European Union is probably, besides the U.S., the you know, doing a lot of work. The NSF is doing a lot, not just on making nanotubes and finding nanomaterials and having and making and then finding uses for nanomaterials, but they also fund research on environmental fate, because they know, well, if we're going to make them, we have to understand how what the fate is. The EPA funds some research, but their research budget is much, much smaller than NSF's to do the type of work. So China, I don't know about. That would actually be a good question. China has lots of other problems that they have to worry about, so I'm not sure what their budget is on nanomaterials.
Jack, we have unfortunately arrived pretty much at the end of our time period, and I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of WildEye. I'd like to give you this little mug over here, which is a souvenir of your wonderful presentation. I think everybody enjoyed it very, very much, and I'd like to say thank you very much. We all enjoy this presentation.